You're listening to Strange by Nature, your guide to the strange, weird, unbelievable, and improbable wonders of the natural world.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for being here today. I am Kirk Mona, and I am joined today by Rachel Ginza and Victoria Thompson. We are all professional naturalists who together have scoured the world for weird and wonderful wonders just to please your mammalian brain's desire for novelty. Isn't that nice? Let's do this.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back to the show. I'm here with Rachel this week. How you doing?
Good. How are you doing, Kirk?
I'm doing fantastic. I'm sorry. We were just laughing before we started the show here, so we're still just having some good times. I'm gonna jump right into things, Rachel. I got a deep question for you.
Yeah. Wait, you have a weird question for me?
No, a deep question for
you. Oh, a deep question. Ooh, even better.
How do you feel about life extension?
Fascinating. I think it depends.
Right?
Yeah.
No, I should clarify. I'm not talking about like immortality, because there's a lot of issues around that. But how about if you could safely say like double or maybe even triple your lifespan? Would you do it? And like you would be healthy. It wouldn't be like you just keep on aging until you were a 200-year-old, you know, decrepit pile of bones. You would like your lifespan would just be you'd be healthy until
I'd be
the
like,
end.
Are we talking like elf kind of thing where like my lifespan is longer or like a dwarf where my life goes longer? But like
yeah.
It expands.
Everything just goes slower.
Okay.
Oh, so when you were
then I would,
80, you'd feel like you were 40.
Okay. We're in like hobbit dwarf territory. Sick. I would actually. One, just for a couple of reasons, actually. Because one, I think I would. There's so much I want to do. And I think this is like.
Right. Right.
What everybody says, right? There's so much that we want to do. And if I have the opportunity to not be a burden, be able to still be able to take care of myself and my like family and friends and stuff.
Yeah.
And if I'm going to be like 80, but feeling like I'm 40 and looking like I'm 40, then like that sounds great personally.
Well, you could do so many different, you get multiple careers and try different things.
I get to try new things. I get to be a part and see all the new research and science that comes out, see where, how, because even from my limited lifespan, society and people have changed so much. And it's so cool to see where things are going and what developments and technologies and things that get pushed and where we go with things. That would be really cool to see and be a part of. If expanding or elongating my lifespan becomes a detriment to others or is
well,
a financial
would,
drain
right?
that
yeah.
I wouldn't be able to cover myself, then I would say no.
Well, and ecologically, say if all the humans on Earth started to live 2 to 3 times longer, that's going to have some profound societal and ecological impacts.
Exactly.
But let's ignore that for a moment, you know, and just say, what if you could increase your lifespan, right? But the catch was that you had to be permanently infected with a tapeworm.
No.
Does that change your opinion?
It does. I'm good.
It does. Oh, funny thing. Yep. It does.
It really, truly, you know, Kirk, are you talking about tapeworms?
Yes. Again. Look, there was an interesting bit of research that came to my attention this past summer, but I've been sitting on it because it was on what's called a preprint server.
Okay.
So for those listeners not in the know, a preprint server is a place that researchers can, I don't want to say publish, because it's different than that. So let's just say post up, like say a draft
they can
of
post
their research
paper. A draft of the paper as it's going through the peer review process.
And the, or even before that, like, so these are usually studies that are complete, but have not been peer reviewed, as you mentioned, and they have not been officially published. So being published, at least when it you know, when things go as they should, means that a respectable journal has looked over the science, had other peers review the science to make sure it holds up, and then and only then release it for publication. The thing is, like, kind of anyone can put something in a preprint server, and nothing has been vetted. So there's really good science on these servers, like brand new stuff. But there can also be bad science. There can be mistakes, and there can be papers that will never end up being published because they turn out to be full of errors. And an important point is that these servers are not for the public, even if you can get access to them. I was going to talk about this story, and then in a twist of fate, our friends over at Science Night podcast had a recent episode where they talk about the perils of preprint journals. So I would recommend you guys go over and check out their episode. It's called A Lunar Odyssey. For more thoughts on that. It's actually a great episode all around. They're talking about the moon and stuff. So shout out to Science Night podcast. Some of our buddies over there, go check them out.
So fun.
But the research that I want to talk about today, I sat on it for 6 months and lo and behold, it has now been peer reviewed and published in Molecular Ecology, which is considered an excellent journal. So yay for peer review. Also, this research is kind of a replication study-ish. This isn't totally new science. It is building upon other studies that have shown similar results, and they were just trying to go a little deeper, get more information, and try to learn more about this. I did see
at
least
one of...
That gives
it a little more credence on my part of things. Like, it's not completely unknown. It's just building on the foundation that's already been established.
Exactly. And there was only one person the same between the two different research teams I could see that did studies on this. It was mostly different people, but one person was probably like, hey, you know about this. Come join us.
Okay.
So what do we know? So here's the deal. I have bad news if you think we're on the verge of an exciting life extension breakthrough, unless, of course, you are an ant. So there are two species I'm talking about this week. First up, the ant species. The ants in question are Temnothorax nylanderi. These ants were first described in 1850, but didn't seem to get much attention until they were studied a bunch more in the 1970s.
Okay.
Is when people started to really do a lot of research with them. Obviously, based on what I'm about to tell you, they have been getting more attention lately. They are found in, say, roughly all of Europe and part of Scandinavia, and they mostly live in acorns or sticks with a queen and up to 200 workers. Now, that might give you a clue about their size. If I said that there are 200 of them inside an acorn, these are not big ants.
Those are tight. How did they find them in 18-whatever?
Well, someone was cracking open acorns. Probably, honestly, back then, ink, quill ink, was often made out of acorn. Some of it could be made out of acorns. So if you were collecting acorns to make some quill ink, you might have cracked some open and been like, oh, there's, gosh, this is full of ants, right?
Okay.
Oh, tiny. So they are very tiny. From what I could gather, they're maybe about 2 millimeters large, which some of the big ones, but that's still really small. This makes sense though, but if you think about the fact that a whole colony can fit in an acorn, they got to be really small. So the other species involved here is the aforementioned tapeworm. This is Anomotenia brevis.
I'm not going to correct you. You're doing great.
Yeah, Anomotenia brevis. We're going to go with that. So what happens is that an ant eats some food that has been infested with tapeworms. And once it sets up inside the ant, interesting things begin to happen.
Hold on. I'm going to pause you for a second.
Yeah.
What do these ants eat that cause them to be infected with tapeworm?
Well, we're getting to that, Rachel.
Oh, okay.
I'm going to make you wait. It'll come full circle. Don't worry.
I believe you. Okay.
Researchers had previously noted, oh, that's very astute of you. They had previously noted that there was some size variation and also color variation in these ants. And they figured out that this variation had to do with which ones of them had this tapeworm in them. So the ones that had the tapeworms were generally bigger and
Makes
maybe
sense.
Even a different color And you're like, well, that's, wow, that's interesting, but why?
Wild,
and
yeah.
Further study has shown there's a whole lot more going on here than just a change in size and color. The infected ants actually seem to benefit from the tapeworm. It produces proteins that help the ant, and many of the proteins are antioxidants.
Okay.
It is believed that the proteins may be what is helping the ant extend its life by 2 to 3 times. So Whoa. They live much longer. Like, they can live like over a decade, I believe. So,
whoa.
Yeah. Now, from what I can gather, this isn't really violating any laws of nature here. Mm-hmm. The infected workers basically live as long as a queen ant would. So okay. It's not like this is unheard of to have any member of this species of ants living this long. The workers don't usually live this long. I think an interesting analogy in humans would be if someone with good healthcare lived twice as long as someone without. It's like, sure. Okay. Healthcare helps you live as long as your species possibly can, mm-hmm. but you don't live twice as long as any other human on Earth just because you got healthcare, right? And it seems like something similar is happening here with these ants. Now, another reason these infected ants may live longer is that they end up living a life of luxury.
Ooh.
So possibly related to the change in their appearance and their size or maybe other signaling methods, they become kind of like nobility, maybe not royalty, but nobility.
Okay.
They basically become well-fed
like a lazy duchess.
Yeah, well-fed and lazy and stop working. And no offense to any of the duchesses who listen to our show.
Right.
So all the other ants just start like feeding them kind of like you would the queen. And they don't really have to ever work anymore. That sounds pretty great. Except that, you know, if they're the only infected ant, you know, sure. Okay. But what if like a large percentage of the colony becomes infected?
Mm-hmm.
So the worker ants that are left behind are trying to take care of and feed all of them, and they can basically work themselves to death trying to feed and serve all the infected ants. So, you know, this could also account for the increased lifespan in a weird way, because the lifespan of the non-infected worker ants actually decrease. So the infected ants are also living longer compared to them because they're just burning out really fast. And as you might guess, too many infected ants can lead to the societal collapse of the entire colony.
Right.
So,
which makes
there
sense.
Is more to this story than just a tapeworm making an ant's life abnormally long. We always have to ask a question in science, which is
why?
Why exactly? There must be some advantage to the parasite. So, sure, keeping your host alive and well fed. You know, that could be benefit enough, I suppose, but there is something more going on here. So this ant is merely an intermediate host for the tapeworm. And I keep calling it a tapeworm, and it is, but like when you picture a tapeworm, you're probably picturing like an adult tapeworm, like a big long thing, right?
Like an adult one that is found in humans and
it's not that. It's sort of like the juvenile version of a tapeworm. It's called a cysticeroid.
Okay.
And it's like basically a little tapeworm larva. Okay.
Okay.
And remember when I said these ants live mostly in acorns?
Yes, I do remember this. Yes. Do they eat the
Any guesses who the primary host is of the parasite?
Squirrels.
That's a good guess. Very good guess.
Rodents?
Not.
Is
nope.
It,
Not a rodent of any kind.
Ooh, okay.
Not a rodent of unusual size either.
Oh. Would it be, I'm trying to think of it, like a blue jay or some sort of bird?
No, you're very close. It's
so close.
Either one of two species, either the greater or lesser spotted woodpecker.
Okay. I'm like, okay, if it's not, then it's like a jay or maybe like a woodpecker. I was so close. Anyway.
Yeah. So think about it this way. By making the ants larger, tastier, and longer lived, the odds of a woodpecker finding one actually increases.
Right.
So when the woodpecker eats the ants, they also ingest the tapeworm cysticeroid, which then grows into an adult in the woodpecker. And those adult tapeworms make more cysticeroids, which then come out in their feces. And Rachel, you asked this at a great question early on. What are the ants eating?
Yeah.
That would lead them to get infected.
Do they eat bird poop, Kirk?
Yeah. They're, I mean, they probably eat other things too, but they do end up collecting the feces. They don't eat it themselves. Mm-hmm. They actually feed it to their young. Because of course they do. So
why
they
not?
Collect up some of this woodpecker poop and they're like, hey, this is very, you know, got a lot of nutrition in it. This is great. They bring it into their colony. They, you know, feed it to their little, you know,
babies,
their little larva there. And so they get it right off the bat. So the adults are bringing it in and not necessarily, as far as they can tell, not eating themselves, but feeding it to their young.
Okay.
So that's not great.
That's gross.
Yeah, I mean, look, we've talked about parasites.
Hey, it's the circle though. Like, it's like how we say with our stuff, right? Like, one man's trash is another man's treasure.
One man's feces is another man's feast.
Apparently today.
But let's not say man, because
no,
it's sexist, and also
one,
I hope humans aren't doing that.
Right.
One being.
One bird's feces is another ant's treasure. Feast.
There you go. You know, we've talked on this show before about parasites manipulating their hosts to do things. And it was really fun to read this actual scientific paper because the authors of the paper also cited some of those very same examples that we've talked about on the show.
Yeah.
Like the malaria parasite making humans smell better to mosquitoes, which I love that one. There's a whole episode on that. If you haven't heard it, check out our archive.
Oh, yeah.
So I will say that the paper they wrote is available in full for free online. Yay, open
love
science.
Love that.
Fantastic. I'm going to try to remember to include a link in the show notes if anyone wants to read this. It's actually a very readable scientific paper. But that's what I want to talk about. Another example of parasites manipulating their hosts. It always makes me wonder how we are being manipulated by parasites. and this is an area of study that they're really just starting to get more attention. And so I'm very interested. And maybe if we can find a way to extend our lives out, we'll get to live long enough to find out the answer about how we are being manipulated by the parasites in us and changing our behaviors and our bodies and whatnot to benefit them. So very cool. Does happen, we'll be sure to let all of you, our dear listeners, know.
For sure.
My source this week was just the main journal article itself. It's called Long Live the Host. Proteomic analysis reveals possible strategies for parasitic manipulation of its societal host. This was by Julianne Hartkel, I believe, et al. In molecular ecology. I also got some little bit of extra information from Wikipedia and a website I did not realize existed until now, AntWiki.
I love
that. For all
of
your ant knowledge needs. Yeah, check it out.
So good.
We're going to take a short break, and our patrons will just zip right on to the next segment. All the freeloaders who have not become patrons yet, sorry. you have to listen to ads. I'm sorry. Skip ahead, and we'll see you in a little bit. You know, as podcasters, we like to listen to podcasts too, and I want to tell you about one this week called Tiny Matters. It's a science podcast about things small in size, a molecule, microscopic organisms, or maybe an ancient gene that all have a big impact on our world. Tiny Matters is produced by the American Chemical Society and hosted by former scientists Sam Jones and Deboki Chakravarti, who chat with experts to track down answers to questions like, how does our brain form memories? Is sugar actually addictive? And are we alone in the universe? And Sam and Deboki know that science doesn't operate in a vacuum, so every Tiny Matters episode is packed with history, as well as societal relevance and impact. A new episode of Tiny Matters drops every other Wednesday. Find it on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Audible, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome back, everyone. Kirk.
That's me.
Apparently, we decided to be gross this week. So last week, I talked about sperm whales.
Yeah.
Right? And did a I did a deep dive with sperm whales.
I hear what you did there.
Thank you. And I'm not done talking about sperm whales. I am kind of done talking about okay. sperm whales. There's one thing that I didn't mention last week. And I wonder
we really are going back into sperm whales again. Okay.
Sort of. Yeah. So this is I actually first heard of this particular topic, believe it or not, on an episode of Bob's Burgers.
Love Bob's Burgers. Big
Love
fan.
Love Bob's Burgers.
Big fan.
So in this particular episode, the kids find something along the beach and they do a little bit of research and they find out that it's something absolutely valuable. It ends up not being that, but then there was, they at the end, they did find, or there was a bit of it actually out on the beach. Anyway, Kirk, do you know what I'm talking about this week?
I know exactly what you're talking about. You're talking about ambergris.
Hell yeah, I am. So this week I am talking about ambergris. So for those of you who don't know and are confused why I started talking about sperm whales again and then brought up this weird word, welcome to the show. So ambergris is actually a really unique substance. It's produced in sperm whales, but also like pygmy sperm whales, which is a...
Okay.
different species of toothed whale. It is a solid, waxy material, and it's only found in 1-5% of sperm whales. So it is not very common at all.
No, yeah, very rare.
And to be honest, I've seen pictures. It looks gross. It looks super gross.
It looks like nasty.
Yeah.
Like a big giant dried booger, basically.
Pretty much. Like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Charming.
It's so charming, which is so wild because when you do find it, if you do find it and you get to sell it, it is worth a lot of money.
Yeah, we've talked about stinky things on the show before that end up being worth a lot of money for the same reason.
This is one of those things.
Yep.
It is a stinky substance. A lot of people think that it actually, at least fresh ambergris, smells like feces. So it smells like poop.
Great.
Yeah.
Lovely.
So it's not great.
No, it's not. No.
Yeah. So it can change color, generally speaking, when it's fresh. When it's fresh, it has like a really strong like poop smell. It smells like poop.
A fecal bouquet.
Great. Thanks, Kirk.
I don't know if I want to make that the show title this week.
Oh, man. That's, yeah.
Oh,
no. Generally speaking, it's like this yellowish, like you described.
The listeners clicked on this. They already know if I had to make that choice or not, but I'm still wrestling with that choice.
That would be a choice, Kirk. It is a, like a yellowy, like booger looking thing. Cause it's a waxy, like material.
Mm-hmm.
So here's the thing. It somehow is a natural like byproduct of the squid that sperm whales eat, okay? Of that diet.
Right.
Somehow it gets extruded or released somehow by the whale, probably gets pooped out. We're going to be honest, it gets pooped out.
Do we know is in what part of the whale this originates? Is it from the intestines or?
Yes.
Okay.
Probably. That's the problem. We don't know. There's a lot of like debate and discussion on what or where ambergris is, like what it is, what
it's
origin, used for, where it's found. A lot of people or a lot of thought and discussion is that it is part of the whale intestine.
Okay.
It's been used for a long, long time, but generally speaking, the idea or the theory behind it is that the squid, a lot of the indigestible elements of the squid, like the beaks and the pens and things, some thoughts is that that gets vomited out.
Love
before
that.
Everything gets digested. Sometimes it, generally speaking, that gets vomited out, I guess. But
this is a gross, gross subject, Rachel.
Sorry. I told you this is unfortunately a gross episode. So most of the time a sperm whale will vomit out those parts that it can't actually digest. But sometimes some of it still goes into its intestine and starts collecting together. And as it collects together, it creates ambergris. And it can grow and grow and grow in the whale. So we think, scientists think that the normal substance is ambergris in like their intestines and actually helps protect their organs from any squid beaks. But we don't know. Especially like scientists don't really know if the ambergris eventually gets vomited out or if it passes along with whale poop eventually.
Well, no one's ever actually seen it, you know, coming out, so to speak.
No.
Noted.
There is a scientist, Richard Sabin. He's actually the principal curator of mammals at the Natural History Museum in Australia.
Okay.
He thinks, with his discussion that apparently they talk about this at lunch. I mean, I understand. I talk about poop at lunch all the time.
It's kind of a natural thing. It comes up almost every meal, which is the most disturbing thing. I'm like, can we not get through one meal without someone talking about feces at a nature center? What is with that?
I don't know. It's wild is what it is. Anyway, so apparently they were talking about it and they think that the ambergris forms in the intestine, starts to be passed along, and it can form an obstruction in the rectum of the sperm whale, which then can, you know,
rectum rupture. Darn near killed him.
Well, actually, it does.
Oh gosh. All right. That joke punchline finally works.
Yeah, some of them think that eventually it gets passed naturally, and then others, like, it just keeps growing and growing, and then eventually ruptures the rectum and, like, just
that's
kills
not a phrase
it.
I wanted to hear.
Sorry.
Okay. And a lot of listeners who don't know what this is are still like, Rachel, why are you talking about this?
Well... it's only found in like less than 5% of whale carcasses. So like, okay. So whale ambergris is this weird substance that we don't know what its purpose is. We don't really know what it's made out of. We don't know how it comes out. We know it comes from sperm whales and it just is around, but humans have been using ambergris for hundreds of years. When it's dried, it is described as a musky smell. So you'll never guess what it is often used for.
I mean, I got a pretty good guess.
Yeah, it's often used to make perfume scent last longer. So
yeah. And just to have the perfume, this thing that comes out of the ocean, probably out of a whale's butt, smells like feces. And someone was like, you know what we should do? We should put this in perfume.
Yep. So what they're able to do is it's ambrion is extracted from ambergris. and then put into perfume to make perfume smell last longer.
Interesting. I did not realize that it had a longevity effect to it. I thought it was just the musky smell itself.
The smell, but it also makes it last longer.
Interesting. Must be a very stable compound in there.
It is pretty stable. What's wild is the fact that the ambergris actually, when it's exposed to air, can change color. And that when it is exposed to air or sea, any sort of oxidation, and it can change color from black to white and be gray, brown, yellowy. And that actually changes the amount of ambrin that is in the ambergris, which is what makes it valuable in the first place.
Yes.
Whales used to be hunted for the ambergris, as well as all of the oil that was found, but it's really, really rare for them to be able to find it in the first place. It can weigh anywhere from 15 grams to 110 pounds.
110 pounds. Jeez.
110 pounds.
That would be worth a fortune.
So
I take
much
it.
Money. But like ancient Egyptians actually used to burn it as incense. Like this has been around for a very, very, very long time. Cool. Ambergris actually also used to be used for flavoring in Turkish coffee. It used to be in hot chocolate. It was considered an aphrodisiac in some cultures. Oh. It was eaten quite often.
No.
Apparently, it was the favorite dish of King Charles II of English. Eggs and ambergris was his favorite food. I'm going to say this right now. You cannot pay me enough.
Nope.
For eating any of that. Like, I don't want to, like, I might be able to see it, but like it's yeah. So to give everyone context too, there in 2021, a piece of ambergris was found. It was even bigger. It was 280 pounds.
Oh my gosh.
And it was valued in US money. It was valued at $1.5 million.
Yeah. I'm sure some people are like, oh, yeah, it's valuable. And you go, oh, no, you ain't kidding.
No, it is very valuable. It has mostly been replaced, obviously. But, yeah. If you do get to use it, I get to have it in a perfume, that is going to be the most expensive perfume ever. But it is indeed very unique, and not all sperm whales actually make this.
Right.
It is absolutely wild. It is known as like floating gold. Like
I can see why.
It's just insane. I just wanted to talk about ambergris this week because it's disgusting. I'm gonna be real honest.
It's gross,
so
but
gross.
It's worth a ton of money, and it's been used for a long time, and it is a useful material.
Yeah. Oh God. Yeah. It's a time.
Do you suppose, Rachel, I'll see my dog, I'll have him out on a hike and he'll find some like dead animal or something and sniff it and be like, oh great. Uh-huh. And he'll like roll around on it, be like, I gotta get this smell all over me. And like, oh my God, it's a rotting carcass of a squirrel. Like, what are you doing? You know?
Mm-hmm.
And do you suppose other animals smell things that we enjoy and are like, oh my God, like on your body? Like, that is the most, I mean, granted, just go walk around the mall, you'll smell some people who have perfume on they think smells good and they smell absolutely wretched. So, maybe it's not such a stretch to think that other animals might think the same thing, because frankly, I think that of a lot of perfumes, but it's smell is a really weird personal thing, you know?
It really is. And it's funny that you mentioned that your dogs and smelly things, because dogs are often used to look and find ambergris because they love the smell.
Yeah.
So sometimes they get used to be able to find that. But no, I absolutely do think that what attracts us as people to others smell wise probably doesn't, like, it's probably not an attractive thing for other animals. Sorry, I got distracted. My snake just yawned. Okay.
Okay.
Anyway, I agree with what you were saying, though, is it absolutely would be, like, it makes complete sense. But that's what I have for you this week. I just want to talk about ambergris because it's a weird and gross substance. And I am so sorry for anyone who follows us on Instagram because it's going to be on the Instagram and it's not great looking.
Woo. Wow, man. That was something, Rachel.
Thank you. I do have some sources. This week, I got my information from lovely Wikipedia. I also got it from the Australian government, the Department of Climate Change, Energy, and the Environment and Water. They had a really great article about ambergris, as well as what happens if you find ambergris in Australia.
Some places it's not legal to collect,
like,
it at all.
Australia, for example.
Like Australia.
also the
Australian listeners.
Yep. Sorry. Also the Australian Natural History Museum had a really great article about ambergris, which was great. So
cool.
That is what I have for you this week. And I think
that's
all
what
you had.
I got for you too. That's it.
Oh, amazing. So if you weren't that grossed out, hopefully we'll see you next week.
Yeah, Bob Victoria will be back next week, and we will have another great episode for everybody.
Yeah. In the meantime, thanks everyone for listening, and we'll see you next week. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks everyone for listening to today's show. Be sure to subscribe. New episodes drop every Wednesday, and we love sharing this strange world with all of our listeners. If you would be so kind as to leave us a 5-star review, that would be great. It lets other lovers of the strange discover the show. You can reach out to us on social media by searching for Strange by Nature Podcast on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. You can send us an email as well. Our address is contact@strangebynaturepodcast.com. If you want more information about the show, you can also check out our website, which is strangebynaturepodcast.com. Until next week, get outside, stay curious, and embrace the strange.